In this hour of midday, reflections on life, death, and the search for meaning with Irv Yalom, who's been called the grand old man of psychiatry. Now 83, Irv Yalom has had a rich and busy life as a master therapist, philosopher, and author of everything from textbooks on group therapy to a novel about Nietzsche and the history of psychoanalysis. Today, Irv Yalom shares stories about his patients, the man who came to him with a case of writer's block, the woman who needed help dealing with a terminal illness, the man who couldn't seem to get past the first date with any woman, the ballerina who feared the best of her life was in her past. Irv Yalom on Midday, after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. One of my favorite pieces of writing is a short story by the late E.B. White called The Second Tree from the Corner. In this story, a man named Trexler goes to a psychiatrist because he's middle-aged and having trouble concentrating, distracted by large, mysterious questions about the meaning of life. His psychiatrist asks Trexler what he wants, and Trexler can't answer. Frustrated after 5 unproductive sessions, Trexler turns the tables on the psychiatrist and asks, "What do you want?" The doctor says, "I know exactly what I want. I want a wing on the small house I own in Westport. I want more money and leisure to do the things I want to do." Trexler hears that and considers it pathetically shallow and suddenly feels sorry for the doctor. Later, walking by a tavern in Manhattan, Trexler feels suddenly invigorated. I'll read from the E.B. White piece now. Suddenly, his sickness seemed health, his dizziness stability. A small tree rising between him and the light stood there saturated with the evening, each gilt-edged leaf perfectly drunk with excellence and delicacy. Trexler's spine registered an ever-so-slight tremor as it picked up this natural disturbance in the lovely scene. "I want the second tree from the corner, just as it stands," he said, answering an imaginary question from an imaginary physician. And he felt a slow pride in realizing that what he wanted none could bestow, and that what he had none could take away. He felt content to be sick, unembarrassed at being afraid, and in the jungle of his fear he glimpsed, as he had so often glimpsed them before, the flashy tail feathers of the bird courage. I share that with you, friends, because it came to mind as I read some of the stories from Dr. Irv Yalom's latest book, Creatures of a Day and Other Tales of Psychotherapy. The psychiatrist in E.B. White's story unwittingly helped Trexler relax about the big questions that were troubling him, but I don't imagine that Trexler's doctor would want to know, as Irv Yalom most certainly does want to know, how he helped his patient. One of the most interesting aspects of Irv Yalom's reflections is exactly that, understanding what aspect of his therapeutic approach and his relationship with a troubled patient actually works to heal. Irv Yalom has been called the grand old man of psychotherapy and one of the most influential psychiatrists of his generation. Since his days in residency at the Phipps Clinic of Johns Hopkins Hospital, Irv Yalom has had a rich and busy life as a master therapist, philosopher, and author of everything from textbooks to novels to memoirs about his practice. His earlier titles include When Nietzsche Wept and Love's Executioner and Other Tales of Psychotherapy, a collection of case studies. Similar to the latter is his latest book, Creatures of a Day. In it, Irv Yalom shares stories about his patients that we'll hear about in this hour of the show, the man who came to him with a case of writer's block, the woman who needed help dealing with a terminal illness, the man who couldn't seem to get past the first date with any woman, and the ballerina who feared the best of her life was in her past. Irv Yalom, welcome to Midday on WYPR in Baltimore. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure hearing that E.B. White story. I'd never heard that story before. It's quite a remarkable story. I'm going to go out and buy it.
It is a remarkable story, and it struck me. It's very similar to sort of the endings of your stories, the way we end up, the takeaway from some of your case studies.
Right. So in that story, the therapist, in a sense, gave him something that he could never possibly have imagined that he was giving him. He was giving him a kind of a look into a certain sort of shallowness of life that the therapist had, which helped the patient appreciate his kind of searching and going deeper and wanting something more than pure possessions in life. It's a remarkable story. I love it. Thank you.
E.B. White mentions in that story that transference takes place during the therapy sessions. I think that's the word he uses. What happens there? The doctor becomes the patient, and the patient.
No. What happens in transference? Mainly, it's a Freudian term, really, and it means that the therapist that the patient is relating to the therapist, not only in terms of who or what the therapist actually is, but on the basis of figures from his past that influence the way he regards the therapist. So several people could see that therapist, and each may feel that therapist to be quite different. And that difference really is related to what the patient brings with him in his or her fantasy life.
In this book, you deal a lot with people who are dealing with big questions about the end of life, especially. And I hope my takeaway is correct, that you wanted to examine or illuminate what it is that you learn from these patients.
Oh, yes. That's very true. I wrote this book. The last book I had written was a novel on the Spinoza problem. And I decided that I really couldn't write novels anymore. I don't think you're going to see many. If you look around, I don't think you're going to see many novelists who are in their 80s. It demands a lot of very, very accurate memory. You've got to know what you've said in the last few chapters. And it becomes harder and harder to write a novel as your memory becomes shorter and shorter. So I decided to write a book of stories. I'd written a couple of others, as you mentioned. Oh, I wrote these somewhat differently. I'm looking through I have a sort of double entry bookkeeping for my notes. I put aside notes, say, this might be interesting for writing somehow. And I'm looking through hundreds of pages of these notes and just kept scouring them, going through one after the other until some idea, some anecdote that happened seemed to throb with energy. And then I built and recalled the story around that episode.
Well,
rather than in, say, Love's Execution, I took the entire history of a patient's therapist. Mm-hmm. Some of these examples in Creatures of the Day are just patients I saw for a single session, but something dramatic happened between us.
Before we go any further, I wonder if we should explain the title, Creatures of a Day. Why don't I read the quote, which is from Marcus Aurelius, and then you could tell us a little bit about why you chose this. I'll read it for our listeners. Dr. Yalom, all of us are creatures of a day, the rememberer and the remembered alike. All is ephemeral, both memory and the object of memory. The time is at hand when you will have forgotten everything, and the time is at hand when all will have been forgotten. All will have forgotten you, excuse me. Always reflect that soon you will be no one and nowhere. Why did you choose that?
Well, one of the stories, the title story of the book, had to do with a patient who was withholding a lot of information about himself to me. And then it all came out. And I wondered why he had been seeing me so long. And that told me these very important things that he had to tell me because some other therapist was going to tell me about them that his girlfriend had seen. So he said that he did not want to tarnish the image I had of him in my mind. And it seemed to me such a strange thing. He's coming here, he's spending time, he's spending money, and giving me a false image of himself. So I start to drill in and look at this issue. Why is it so important for him to have this image of him in my mind? And then I thought of Marcus Aurelius. I thought of that phrase, we are but creatures of a day. And what does it serve him for an over 80-year-old man to have a certain image of his mind when that'll all be transient, all be vanishing. So that's when I suggested that he take a look at this Meditations of Marcus Aurelius and hoping that this passage will have some meaning for him. As it turned out, he did read Marcus Aurelius, but he found something else in Marcus Aurelius of even greater interest. And that, in a sense, and by the way, there was a second patient I saw the same day who had given Marcus Aurelius to him for an entirely different reason. He read Marcus Aurelius and found something quite different there. So it's a theme of the book that if we create a certain kind of intimate, trusting, authentic relationship with a patient, they will draw out of it something that we may never have imagined that they would have known. And sometimes we never know this. And in this instance, I described two patients who got something out of it that is so different from what I had expected. I wanted to end this story with a poem. I couldn't do it. It just was too awkward. But there's a poem of E.E. Cummings that I absolutely love. It's called Molly and Millie and Minnie and May Go Down to the Sea One Day to Play. Four women, they go down to the sea, and each takes something very different out of the beach. And it ends up with this phrase, you know, whatever we seek, like a you or a me, it's always ourselves we find at the sea. And that's such a good, it's so relevant for psychotherapy.
It is, yeah,
reading Marcus Aurelius, right. You know. The patient will take out of what they need, what they can find. So that's what I was trying to indicate with that title.
One more thing that's interesting about Marcus Aurelius, just from my notes from your book here, because you referred to his meditations in great detail in chapter 10, I think it is. He didn't want to be emperor. He wanted to be a philosopher. So he wrote messages from the deep part of himself to his everyday self in the hopes that would make him a good man.
Right. Yes, he was not an emperor's son. He was adopted by an emperor because he showed such unusual ability as a very young man. And so he was appointed emperor, but it was never what he wanted to do. He spent his whole life defending the borders, northern borders of the Roman Empire against barbarians. Whereas he really wanted to be a philosopher. And so every day he dictated his memoirs to a Greek slave that he had, and that was this book. It's full of pearls of wisdom.
Irv Yalom, Dr. Yalom, I want to start with the story of the man who had writer's block. I think it was Mr. Andrews. I'm going to just read the opening here, and then I want you to tell our listeners this story, because this is really a remarkable story about psychotherapy. You receive an email, and the email says, Dr. Yalom, I would like a consultation. I've read your novel, When Nietzsche Wept, and wonder if you'd be willing to see a fellow writer with a writing block. So please take it from there. You agreed to see him for one session.
Yes, he said he could only afford one session. He didn't have financial means to see me more. And so I started to see him, and I tried to find out more about the writing block. But he said he wanted me to read his correspondence with a very eminent professor. But it was a correspondence that ended many years ago, a correspondence that had begun 30 to 40 years ago. And no matter what I did, he kept pressing this on. I said, how can I read this? We only have this 1 hour. Read it, please. And so I started to read it. And then after reading it for much of the session, I gave him my take on it. You know, the take on it was this was a really important relationship, that this professor valued you. You valued him. There was something very meaningful between the two of you. But then I tried to find out what was going on. Why did he want me to read this? Maybe this relationship was a great love relationship of his life. Maybe he was in deep grief about this, but he didn't want to hear any of that. He simply wanted me to read this passage and tell him that this was indeed a very significant relationship and someone who meant a lot to him, thought well of him. So I'm guessing maybe this was a gay relationship. Maybe he's looking around for someone to replace him. Maybe that's why he came to me. He was writing his dissertation on Nietzsche. Maybe it had something to do with my having written a novel on Nietzsche when he had wanted to write a novel on Nietzsche. But he wouldn't answer any of these questions. And finally, he says, at the end of the session, he says, I'm sorry, Dr. Yellen, but our time is up. And he gets up and leaving me full of questions and queries. But he, again, like the man in Marker, he had gotten what he wanted out of the session.
And this man was an octogenarian, right? He was in his, I think you said he was in his 80s.
Yes, he right? was. Right.
So he hands you this, what looks like a manuscript. It's actually correspondence between him and this professor. And you spend most of the session reading that.
Right.
Not the conventional asking of questions and listening to the patient.
Right.
And, and then you say, yeah, this is funny, you say at the end, before you leave Paul, you refer to him as Paul, I've always found it important to understand what helps. Could you expound for a moment on what you received from me? And that's when he says, I'm afraid our time is up, Dr. Yellen. Okay. We'll have to take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more. Irv Yalom is our guest. His latest book is Creatures of a Day. This is Midday on WYPR. We'll be right back. Though research on effective psychotherapy continually shows that the most important factor determining outcome is the therapeutic relationship, the texture, the creation, and the evolution of this relationship are rarely a focus of training in graduate programs. I'm quoting there from your reflections at the end of the book, Dr. Yalom, Irv Yalom, our guest, yes. His book, Creatures of a Day. You know, this interest that you take in what you have done for the patient, that seems to be, you know, your MO is to ask, always wanting to know and almost always asking how you have helped a patient. You see this all as part of the relationship that's essential to healing.
Right, I do that. It's always a question that I ask it when I ask my patients.
How does it relate to the healing of that patient?
Well,
or does it help you? Is it meant to help you?
No, it helps me. It helps me learn more, continuously learn more about my work as I go through this. But I always want to find out what were the times that we're talking about. I try very hard to say to patients from the very beginning, the very first session, I say, you know, to do well in therapy, I think it's very important that you take a risk every session. And I use that statement, and I come back to that statement because there'll be times when I don't think therapy is very effective. We've not had a very good session. It's kind of distant, and we're impersonal. So I'll take the patient back to that. I said, remember what I said to you about taking a risk? Do you think that's happening today? And they'll say no. And I say, well, how do we explain this? What's happened today? When were you closest to taking a risk? What stopped you? And so I'll very much explore the here and now and what we're doing that feels right and feels helpful to the patient and what we're not doing at times and how do we avoid that time. So the here and now, looking, I heard that one of your programs is called the here and now. Mm-hmm. But the here and now in therapy means we are exploring in minute detail exactly what's happening in this process between me and the patient.
Well, in light of that, could you talk about Ellie? Let's talk about Ellie, who had terminal cancer. She's uncomfortable talking to you about that. And you say, and I think this is a good case to talk about, because initially a lot of the folks that the patients you've seen are seem to hide a real fear of death that they have. In this case, it's quite acute because a woman has terminal cancer, but you find this in other people too. Anyway, she's uncomfortable talking about this.
Yes, well, Ellie Ellie came in to see me with advanced ovarian cancer. That's her real name, by the way. I use very heavy disguises in every other patient, and they read the story several times during the writing of it to make sure that I have their full permission. Mm-hmm. But Ellie insisted that I use her real name, so I used her real first name, not the last time, just wanting to keep the family out of this entirely. But she really wanted to speak to others about what she was going through. And so she came to see me. And incidentally, there was an intervention really about the here and now right in my first session with her, because she came up to my apartment in San Francisco. I'm on the top of one of the big hills in San Francisco. She was very tired and sweating, and then we talked for a little while, and she was telling me about herself, and then she said, as she was thinking about her life, you know, I wondered if she had any regrets about her life. I always ask people that. I think it's really important, because one of my objectives in therapy is trying to help patients live a regret-free life. You know, they're living their life now without building up more regrets that they're going to feel a year from now or 2 years from now. So I was asking her about whether she has regrets in her life. And she said, well, she has some. She hasn't been bold enough. She hasn't really asked for enough money for her work. She hasn't done enough for herself in many ways. And so then, and this is very typical of the way I work, I will move that into the here and now. And I'll say, well, Ellie, I wonder if you've been bold enough here today with me. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, no, I haven't been bold enough. So I try to help her say that. Sometimes I'll use a conditional voice. I'll say, if you were to be bold here with me, what might you say? You see, that makes it a little safer, what might you say, rather than really say it. So she says, well, I think I would say to you, why are you charging me so much money? Why do you need so much money? Which was a little flustering. That was a kind of embarrassing for me to have to deal with that question, but I did. I told her I was embarrassed by the question, and she's raised a really important issue, and I had already learned that she really had very little money, and I offered to see her at a very small portion of what I originally charged her. But anyway, that was a good way for us to start, and then slowly she began to talk to me about her cancer. I've spent a lot of time working with people who have cancer. It started off years ago when I was at Hopkins. I began being interested in all that psychiatry is not drawing from philosophy, all these great thinkers, great psychological thinkers that we're really not using. And when I was a resident at Hopkins, I started taking an undergraduate courses in philosophy there, beginning my education in philosophy. And certainly, of all the various threats that we have in our life, our fear of death is one of the greatest, and we have to face this. But the way that I could learn about this was to really work with dying patients. So for many, many years, I led groups for dying patients, patients who had some kind of terminal issue. And even now, I always see a couple of patients in my therapy. I don't have a large practice anymore, but I still see patients who are facing death. And so I worked with her, and we met for several weeks until she died. And she told me she was a wonderfully gifted writer, and it was very important for her and very important for me that I get her words into the story and get the message to other people. So that's my homage to Ellie. It's a little different from the other stories, I wanted to capture her voice very much.
Yes, you reflect on her. You went back and reread some of her emails and noticed how rich and deep her thoughts were, and that she said at one point, "Irv puts me at ease, and he's not afraid to go into the darkness with me." So
She hadn't appreciated really that I didn't go all the way in, mm-hmm. because when I, after her death, I was away a short sabbatical, a writing sabbatical, and she wrote me, and she died shortly thereafter, and I was aware that as I start reading all of her letters to me, all of her notes and all of her words, that I hadn't really registered a lot of them, that even though I was trying to be with her. In fact, I had kept my distance from her. Otherwise I would have remembered these words more the first time. So it shows to me how hard it is for us to really live with death and live with full awareness of that. But a long time ago, when I was seeing a lot of patients who were facing death, I heard one person say, and many people use other language, but that person said, what a pity it was that I had to wait till now, till my body was riddled with cancer, to learn how to live. So that struck me like a thunderbolt. In other words, now that they're faced with death, they suddenly learn something about life and they can live in a somewhat different way. So my mission became with patients, well, how can I help them learn that when they're still healthy, before they're struck with a fatal disease, and get that benefit of living differently in life?
Hmm. Let's talk about Charles then. Let's move on to the 37-year-old business executive who's doing pretty well in life, certainly has the pedigree, Ivy League education.
Charles.
Successful parents.
I never remember the names because, of course, I'm using fictitious names.
This is chapter two on being real, right?
Sure.
He's got a nice condo. He drives a Jaguar. He's got a pretty wife, but chronically insecure, nervous all the time. Had a friend or became a business partner and mentor who committed suicide. You remember Charles?
Right, I remember him well.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And you had to explore that relationship that Charles had with that man, that business partner and mentor.
Well, that was the first thrust of the story. Mm-hmm. He had finally found the father he had lost when he was a young child, and this man was a mentor and a friend, and they had long, deep talks with him. He valued their relationship so much. And then one day he learned from the man's wife, widow now, that he had died. And he was very, very deeply affected by this. And we spent some sessions talking about his grief for that. And then one day he came in even more deeply mired in anguish, because the widow had come to see him and told him something that she knew he was going to find out, because it was now becoming common knowledge, that it wasn't that he had died of a heart attack, as she had first told him, but that he had committed suicide. And what this meant to him, he began to reflect on all this time that they were really together, and he felt they were so intimate, and they were sharing so much, and yet all that time this man was contemplating killing himself. So it really brought into mind what the nature of reality was, that the reality he thought that he was going through with this man wasn't the other man's reality at all. And in some ways we began to discuss that we sometimes think we're having a very deep relationship with someone else, but it's very hard to truly know what that other person's world is, because we construct so much of our own reality. You know, according to Kant, our neural mechanisms construct the appearance of reality to us, but we don't know really what the other's true reality is. You know, and I was free associating for a bit there, talking to him about that, and I started talking about coffee and how the way I could taste coffee is never going to be the same as the way he tasted coffee. And then I thought of something I had read on a website called, I think it's Post Secrets, where a person who worked at Starbucks, this was a secret that she was confessing to the public at large without using her name. She worked at Starbucks and she said, when customers are rude to me, I give them decaf. That was a big confession that she made.
I like anyway, that. So why did that come to mind in speaking with Charles about James?
Well, it was just the idea that the world that you're inhabiting is not really necessarily what you think the world is.
You may be drinking decaf
when you're drinking decaf.
Right.
So I was, but it was a way of my being real with him, but my giving him some of my free associations.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting what you were saying about that relationship. So, did Charles I mean, how did Charles do through this? Where did that leave him? Leaving him thinking his relationship with this man he thought was a friend and mentor, a business partner, was a lie. I don't know if he used that word, but it wasn't really a friendship. But I have to ask you this question. If someone doesn't share with you that they're having suicidal thoughts, does that mean they're not your friend? They're not their intimate friend?
It means that they're not telling you some of the most important things that are troubling them. Now, maybe they have reasons for it. Maybe they don't want to burden you with this or not, but I still think you can draw closer. And that's what we can do in therapy. That's what I did with Charles. That's why I was sharing so much of myself with Charles, that we could be more open. And the therapy ended in that session ended in an interesting fashion, because at the very end, Charles said to me, "Oh, this must be so hard on you. You must be really fatigued after hearing all this." And I sort of stood up, you know, as quickly as I could for an 80-year-old man, and said, "No, I'm fine. I feel invigorated." And then Charles left my office. And then as soon as he left my office, I feel, oh, my God, here I want to be real with him, and I'm lying. I'm really exhausted. So I opened my door and called him back. He'd partway down the hall. So I said to him, "Charles, you know, look, I want to be more honest with you. The truth is I really am tired. I'm really exhausted. This has been very moving for me and very wearing. So I want to take that back by not being tired." And he says, "Oh, Irv, I knew that. I know you a lot better than you think I do. But at least we could be real then." And I think that's what therapists need to be with patients. I think they help them more if they can be real with them. So, and, you know, that's not new. Carl Rogers, the really one of the early psychologists who really did a lot of research on the benefits of psychotherapy, stipulated that his research showed that the therapeutic relationship, the nature of it, is so important for the outcome of therapy. The therapist has to be, and he had a triad of characteristics. The therapist has to be genuine, has to have accurate empathy, and the third one is he has to have positive, unconditional regard for the patient. And there must be 1,000 PhD dissertations testifying to the value and necessity of these factors in that therapist. And today we often overlook that, but it's very true.
Before we leave that story about Charles, and we have to take another break here, just wonder, where did you leave him? Where did that leave him? How do you think you helped him?
Well, I think that Charles was able to learn how to relate more deeply to others, to his wife and to his friends, eventually as a result of relating more deeply to me. So that's actually the forming a good relationship with a therapist isn't the goal of therapy. It's a way to achieve a goal, because he's not going to know me once he ends therapy. So it's that he's learning how to be intimate with others. And the relationship that he has with me becomes a kind of internal reference point in his mind. As he tries to form intimate relationships with me, he has the knowledge that he was really able to do this at one point with me. He'll be able to do this with other people as well. So I think he learned a lot about relationships.
Irv Yalom is our guest, novelist and psychiatrist. In his new book, Creatures of a Day, offering 10 tales from his clients that illuminate the gifts of psychotherapy, particularly the hopeful lessons one can glean from it in the context of aging and death. More with Irv Yalom when we get back. This is Midday. Over and over again, the patients in these tales found benefit in ways I could not possibly have anticipated. One patient anoints me as witness to the fact that a significant person had deemed him significant. A patient's sense of fractured reality is mended by an unflinchingly authentic encounter with her therapist. Another grasps that real life is lived in the present moment. Another patient's life is changed by my referring him to a household organizer. A nurse is introduced to her better self. A muted writer finds her voice, a dying patient's last days, are imbued with meaning when she serves as a pioneer of death for her friends and family. Quoting there from the afterword to Irv Yalom's latest book, Creatures of a Day. There's a reference in there to the next person I wanted to ask you about, Dr. Yalom. This is Alvin the radiologist. I enjoyed this story immensely. So Alvin has a problem. He comes to see you. He's a good-looking guy, self-assured physician, but no social life, not many friends, and he's failing at romance. He can't seem to get past the first date with women. Is that right?
Yes, but that wasn't really the reason he came to see me. The reason he came to see me at first, well, this was the first part of the story, was that his brother had died, a brother that he was extremely alienated from. But at the very end of his life, he went to see him, and his brother had had a doctor send him his X-rays, he had a lung cancer and died. But after that, he was pretty shaken at his work, because he's the person who writes these readings of the scans that are bringing news of a fatal illness to patients. He never really saw the patient, though, and so it began to shake him up in his work. He was very frightened by having a lot of nightmares, and so we worked through some of that. But then I began to raise some questions. I always ask patients as I work with them, one of the questions I ask patients is to take me through a 24-hour day. I like to do that do it in an early session, some of the first session, do it in some exquisite detail. You know, I learn about their sleep, I learn about their dreams, because I do like to work with dreams with patients. But one of the things I'm really listening for is who else enters their life? What's their social network like? And this was a man I began to hear, takes all of his meals alone. He rarely sees anyone else. He's devoted to work. His pleasures are sort of solitary, canoeing or hiking. And so I began to ask about his social interactions, and he told me a bit about dates, but he wasn't really too interested in talking about this. And I almost had to push pretty hard. And then he told me, well, he actually, as you mentioned, he's a very attractive man. He's single, never married, never been involved deeply with a woman. He says, well, he has dates. He sees them one time, but then they never want to see him again. And then finally I kind of wrestle out of him the fact that when they come to visit him at his home, they never want to come back. And then finally talk about what's happened. And then I kind of press really hard to say, let me do a home visit on you. I began being very, very curious about his home. And when I went to see his home, against his wishes, I really, really almost bludgeoned him into letting me come to visit him.
This is highly unusual, right? To have a session.
I was out of control.
Okay.
I just could not quell my curiosity.
Okay.
So I came to his house. I could see him through the window, sitting in the far edge of the room. He said, come in. I opened the door, but I had my trouble walking to him because his house was filled several feet high with newspapers and telephone books, the common thing we see today is hoarding, but there was no mention in the literature of hoarding. This was a whole new phenomenon to me 20 years ago. And so it turned out he was a rather severe hoarder. And then after that episode, he would not come to see me again. Maybe he was full of shame. Maybe there's just too much resistance to changing. But he never saw me again. And then I didn't see him again for 20 years. And then I met him by sheer chance at the funeral of someone who had been kind of a bookkeeper, jack of all trades, helping me out with things. She did odd jobs around the house. I had known her for a long time. Very intrusive, but very effective lady. And then I met him at the funeral, and he wanted to have a follow-up with me. I saw he was married. He had a beautiful wife with him and children. So we had coffee afterwards and talked about it. And I said, well, you know, I'm very curious. What were you doing at this woman's funeral, at Gail's funeral? He says, well, you introduced me to Gail. Don't you remember? And I'd forgotten all about it. He said that when I refused to come see you, you gave me the name of your house organizer and bookkeeper. And I've been seeing her for 30 years after she comes every week and gets things organized for me and helps my house being organized. And I met this lovely woman. And we've had a very good life.
She helped him get all that clutter out of his house.
She was a real therapist. She got that clutter out of him, out of his house, and cleaned up his life. And I would never have known that had we not met at her funeral.
I'm struck by something in that story I wanted to ask you about. When he stopped seeing you, or he stopped coming to sessions with you, Alvin the radiologist, he was worried about your opinion of him.
Yes, I think he was. I think he was very ashamed. I think no one had ever really known about the way his house looked, except for these women who would never come back to him. So he got clear messages about that, yet somehow felt completely unable, helpless himself, to be able to do anything about this.
Well, but I need to ask you this, Irv Yalom. If you have sort of guru status with some people, right, they may feel like they're not living up to some kind of standard or they're disappointing you, letting you down. You even mentioned Charles a little while ago was sort of apologetic for having, burdened you with his stories. So do you find that happens sometimes? You have to get over that with patients?
Well, not with Alvin, because, you know, I first ran into him about 35 years ago. So we were just, we were fellow staff physicians at Stanford.
Ah.
So, no, not with him. But now, yeah, a lot of people come to see me because they idealize me. You know, there's got to be, for many of us, we really need to have some wise old man up there who knows everything, and people kind of put that on to me. I feel I'm idealized to a great extent. Everyone imbues me with a lot more wisdom than I have.
Well, can I ask you this? When you have a session with a patient, I'm sure you've had a patient say to you, so what do you think I should do?
Yeah.
Right? They want your advice.
Well, that depends very much on what. I can't answer that in general, but I try to. First of all, I try to use the idealization that they have of me. It may be giving me powerful ways to interact with patients. Sometimes in a single session, they can take something out of it, or I can shed light on them. So I kind of like seeing people sometimes for a very brief period of time. My therapy has changed now that I've aged, and at the current time, for the last 3 or 4 years, I only see patients for the maximum of a year and see what work I can be done in a year. That's not a new idea. Peter Werther, Otto Ronk, one of Freud's associates, used to do this back in the beginning because he said that made the patients work harder and more effectively. People do, but I don't think people come to me and really will ask me about what I ought to do at asking me for advice. A lot of people do that, however, by email. I get a ton of email, and then I just tell them, look, these are important issues, they have important ramifications. You need to see someone and talk about it at some length. So
right.
I will avoid that. Once in a while, I will feel something that I will give strong advice for. A mother, for example, someone I saw recently who has not, her son has not spoken to her for all these years. And she's getting old, and she wants her son, she wants to make contact with her son, but she is too proud to kind of reach out to her son and to say this. And I worked very hard with her and gave her advice. I said, look, you know, you're the adult in this relationship, and you've got to reach out. Maybe you've even got to say that you're in therapy, and maybe you've got to say that you've got some regrets for some of your behavior when you're younger, but you'd like to make a new start with him. So, yeah, I'll give that kind of advice when I'm absolutely certain. Absolutely certain it's the right thing to do to open up some communication. It's important for both of them.
Dr. Yalom, in the time remaining in our hour together here, because it is a 50-minute hour about.
A 50-minute hour. Where did the time go?
I thought we...
It goes fast when you're having fun. And you've really read this book very carefully. Yeah. And I love your being able to go into this book. So how do you do it? You probably do several books a week.
I have some help here.
Okay.
In this case, from one of your fans. But listen, can we end the hour with the story of the ballerina, the 70-year-old former ballerina, Natasha? I think there's a wonderful story and a great takeaway here.
Well, Natasha is a woman who came to me in the first session, and she did something that I had never... I thought I'd seen everything, but I had never seen this before, where she gave me a beautiful picture of herself as a young ballerina, and then stared at me as I stared at this picture. She was lovely, and she asked me very coyly, was I not beautiful? And the story began by my saying something to her about whether or not she always thinks of herself in the past tense. And then she accused me of asking such a rude question. And she said something to the effect, I don't have the story in front of me, but she, obviously you've taken the bad manners course that all therapists take, you know. And then we talked about that for a while. And it turned out that she was in a peculiar state of mind, and she felt separated. She felt everything seemed unreal in her life, and it happened rather suddenly, about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And we sort of did a detective search, she and I, to try and figure out when had it begun. And it had begun when she had gone to a show on the history of ballet at a museum in Washington. And when she went into that show, she was a prima ballerina in her day, very well-known ballerina. And so she went in there looking for pictures of herself, but also for pictures of her husband, a man who was a very, very great dancer, and was shaken up when there were no pictures of him there, nor pictures of her. And that was when this period of unreality started. So we went back and started analyzing this, and analyzing her sense that she was, that life was real back then, but in fact life had been a horror to her then, and she had settled in now to a 20-year marriage with another wonderful man, had never been so peaceful, but this piece of her that felt that life was lived back then, back when she was so scarred. So that's how our session began. We did very good work, and I think in a short period of time.
You dealt with the dangers of death ahead, aging, no longer being young, and worrying too much that the best part of her life was in her past.
And did some interesting dream work with her, too. A dream opened up the therapy for us to a great extent.
Well, Irv Yalom, I've enjoyed having some time with you in this hour. Thank you for making time for us.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
And I know I've heard from lots of people this week, several people this week, who heard you were going to be on the show and said, oh, please tell him he's one of my heroes. These are people involved in your world, in psychology, psychiatry, social work, and therapy. So I pass that along to you.
And also, I'm delighted to talk with you from Baltimore. Those three
years at Johns
Hopkins changed my life. And I still see those 3 years more clearly than I see things last week. You know, I see the important professors that I had there in my days at the Phipps Clinic there with great tenderness.
Thank you, Dr. Yalom.
You're welcome.
Irv Yalom's latest book is Creatures of a Day and Other Tales of Psychotherapy. I hope you've enjoyed our program. This is Dan Rodgers from Midday. Please enjoy the remainder of this music as we say goodbye to you, and we'll see you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Marjorie Goodman, Aaron Morenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.